that intellectuals find themselves in. This has a lot to do with the issue of how intellectuals earn a living, right? We were talking about last week about whether it was possible to train people to become public intellectuals. Let's say we put aside that matter. Nevertheless, public intellectuals need to earn a living somehow. And so there are issues of money. And also public intellectuals, part of their definition is that it would try to have an impact on society. And that obviously means that what they're going to say is going to have some political relevance. So there's always the potential, if you're a public intellectual, to get into trouble. Right? I mean, that's kind of the name of the game. So in that respect, being a public intellectual, it's not something meant for the squeamish, right? But then the question is, well, how do you make a living out of this and keep yourself out of jail? Right? That's a tough question that we need to tackle here. Now, one thing I think that's very interesting is why this kind of issue arises in the first place. One of the points that I've been stressing in the course so far is the degree to which public intellectuals, in a sense, the way they write, the way they communicate, is they are trying to address you directly, right? They are trying to force you into a position where you have to make a decision about some important issue, right? That you just can't be passive sitting there. And so, as a result, public intellectuals arouse very strong passions in people. And so you can then see the potential for how these guys could get into trouble. Now, one of the things that I talk about in the book, The Intellectual, that's relevant to this, a historical episode, which took place in the 18th century. And this is in the chapter that has to do with the paranoid tendencies of intellectuals. And it's a very defining moment, I think, in terms of what a public intellectual is. And this has to do with the earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal. Okay, there's a major earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal. It killed 3,000 people and caused all sorts of untold damage. It was widely reported and talked about. I mean, this is the period, it's the middle of the 18th century, so this is the period where you're just beginning to see newspapers. So there is a sense in which a public sphere is beginning to develop in Europe. And so this is the kind of an event that really strikes people, and people report and talk about it and basically try to explain it. How did it happen, right? In the middle of the 18th century, we've got this earthquake in Portugal where houses, the whole city is destroyed. 3,000 people died. 3,000 people died in the World Trade Center thing at 9/11. Okay, so put that in perspective. This kind of, okay, except Portugal, you know, Lisbon, smaller city, smaller scale, right? 3,000 means a lot more back then. And obviously 3,000 now means something. I mean, we're still kind of talking about this 9/11 thing. But imagine what 3,000 was back then, okay? Now, the interesting thing about the Lisbon earthquake, of course, is that it was an earthquake. It wasn't suicide bombers crashing into the buildings, but it was an act of nature, right? It was an act of nature. This was a very interesting time for this sort of act of nature to take place, right? Because we're talking about a time that's the Enlightenment, right? The 18th century is the Enlightenment, and people are arguing about whether they should be ruled by church authority, and there's a general skepticism about authority as a whole, within the next generation you'll start to see revolutions, both in America and in Europe. And so there is this sense that human beings can take control of their affairs. They don't need to believe in some kind of authoritarian god or priests or anything like that, or even kings, right? They can take affairs into their own hands. And all of a sudden, you get this earthquake. 3,000 people died. Now, of course, it's very natural under these circumstances, and, you know, if you imagine this sort of thing happening now, right, you get these Bible Belt people, and this is what they said, actually, about 9/11, right? Fundamentalists basically say, ah, God's sending you a signal, man. Don't get beyond your station. Don't get above your station. You think you can understand how the world works. You think you can take the world into your own hands. Well, hey, there's a guy upstairs who's much stronger than you, and he's going to teach you a lesson. Boom, 3,000 die in this city. Okay? And that was, in fact, one of the ways in which the theological authorities at the time were interpreting this event. Okay? So the idea was, hey, this is a wake-up call that you ought to be obedient to God, and you shouldn't mess around, and you shouldn't, like, build these large cities and stuff like that, and that you should be mindful of your place in nature is definitely subordinate to God. And so this was a theological response. And then if you learn the lesson, then this will have been worth the loss. That was a theological response, okay? So sort of in a give it a kind of moral justification. Now, the person who was most prominent at the time for opposing this viewpoint was Voltaire, okay, who is, of course, known as an intellectual and very famous one. But Voltaire's view, which reflected, I think, the viewpoint of scientists who didn't see themselves as particularly affiliated with the church, his view was, this is just an act of nature. These things just happen. Right? Yes, in a way it shows that human beings can't control how the world works, but that doesn't mean it proves the existence of God or shows that God is somehow trying to teach us a lesson. It's just that nature has laws unto itself, which perhaps we may be able to discover through science, but in any case, it's independent of our control. And you've just got to expect that in the normal course of things, things will happen. Okay? And that you just can't, there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to live with that fact. Now, you see, this kind of line that Voltaire was pushing was quite interesting because it wasn't a kind of pro-empowerment line on the part of human beings. It was, in fact, a relatively pessimistic line. Okay? Basically say, you know, there's no God, but the humans can't control it either. That, you know, nature rules all at the end. Okay? And this kind of viewpoint wasn't, in a sense, while he was talking about this as a kind of scientific viewpoint, it's a viewpoint that actually has a longer kind of metaphysical, philosophical heritage that goes back to people who you may have heard of, if you've done some philosophy, Epicureans from ancient Greece. These people lived basically the generation after Aristotle, after Athens is conquered by Sparta and then Persia and then Rome, and you know everybody conquers Athens over the next 1,000 years. And the Epicureans, right, is that the whole point of life is to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, with the emphasis on the minimizing pain. Okay? So in other words, you don't want to get yourself into a position where you raise your expectations about what you think you can control in your life to such an extent that you just end up getting perpetually disappointed. Right, so the Epicurean, in a way, it's kind of therapeutic philosophy, a sort of self-therapy kind of thing, right? And that all of the problems that human beings run into is because they overestimate the powers. Okay. Now, the Epicureans, like Voltaire, are not making this argument from the standpoint of there's a God out there who, in fact, is in control and does know what's going on. That's not the point of the argument. The argument is that nature, in a certain level, is kind of arbitrary, right? It's, you know, that you know, nature has a mind of its own, and we can't quite fathom it. We can try through science to get some angle on it, but we're never going to really be able to fully control it. This viewpoint, by the way, this general viewpoint that I'm attributing to Epicureans and Voltaire, is also a view that Darwin held. Darwin also held this view about natural selection. That was Darwin's view. And Darwin would be incredibly surprised by the developments in biotechnology and our ability to actually bioengineer things. He would never believe such things as possible. Okay? And I think similarly with these guys, very pessimistic about exactly just how much control over nature science could gain. Okay? Okay, so I mentioned these guys, but then there was a third position. And the third position is the most interesting position from the standpoint of the history of public intellectuals. And that position was at the time articulated by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another Enlightenment thinker, and kind of a very difficult person, a person who was, you know, Voltaire was actually, well Voltaire was a radical guy. He was also quite a popular guy. He wrote a lot of plays, and he was a well-known literary figure and so forth. Rousseau, on the other hand, while he was also famous, he was also kind of notorious because he was seen as holding some very strange views about things. And one of the things that Rousseau believed about this situation was that human beings were responsible for the earthquake. Okay? That's the key, right? He believes it's not God, it's not nature, it's us. It's our fault. Because who asked these Portuguese to build these houses in these fault lines? Right? Come on. Yeah, we've got science, but we've got responsibility, too. And this was the most controversial view to hold at the time. Okay? But the reason why I bring it up in terms of what a public intellectual is because the public intellectual takes this event, right, which seems like this kind of arbitrary, natural event over which no one could have any control, and then immediately throws it back at the public and says, it's your fault. Now, this kind of move has been made periodically in the history of public intellectual life, and I think one of the most famous moments of it came when Jean-Paul Sartre, after the detonation of the atomic bomb over Hiroshima in Japan, 1945, he basically said, this is all our fault. We are all implicated in this, because we have allowed this to happen. We allowed the physics to develop to such a point that this bomb could be used, and we stood behind the Allies, and we signed off when the Americans did this. So we are all complicit. Okay. Now the interesting thing about Sartre, and this is also true, I think, of Rousseau's view about this matter, is that people who do not object are complicit. That's the thing. Because I think we like to live in a moral universe where on difficult matters, you've got three options. You know, you either support the proposition, you oppose the proposition, or you just sit it out. Especially when it's really difficult, right? A lot of people want to just sit it out. You know, Nazis making a lot of noise, let's say, in 1936 or 37. What's going to be your attitude? For, against, I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm going to sit it out. I'm going to wait. I'm going to sit it out. Okay? Well, from the standpoint of the public intellectual, the third option doesn't exist. Right? If you don't object, you're for. Okay? And that's the sense in which we are all complicit, let's say, in the creation of the atomic bomb. And this is Rousseau's view, as well, with regard to all of the stuff that happened in Lisbon. Namely, come on, somebody had to put up this idea to build all these homes, right, in these tricky areas. And why did they build these homes? Well, because they thought they would be attractive, it would attract wealthy people, it would build up the economy, and for the same reasons why you get property development today. No different in the 18th century, okay? And so people thought this was wonderful. And you know, what's the chances that anything horrible like this was going to happen? Really small. Hey! No problem. Take the risk. Okay, take the risk, but then take seriously the idea that when you take the risk, you're taking responsibility. You know, sure, you take the risk, and it's your responsibility. Just like when you gamble, and you lose. You lose. And it's, you know, you're the one who loses. You don't blame it on something that somehow mitigates the situation. You just lose the money. And likewise, you risk your life moving into this place, and the place collapses. Well, you've risked your life, basically. It's your fault. So you've always got a decision. You've always got a choice to make here. Okay? And this was regarded, and this was the first time that actually someone made this kind of point. That even when we talk about things that are as remote, you know, as acts of nature, where we're talking about large scale, you know, things happening underneath the earth, you know, that are really quite removed from the context in which we normally think about things and make our decisions. Nevertheless, we are still responsible. Now, you see, this has a lot of, I think this should have a lot of resonance with the global climate stuff that's going on now, right? The way in which the global climate stuff is very much discussed in terms of urgency, right? We've got to do something. You've got to do something in your home, you know, to cut down your carbon emissions, lessen that carbon footprint you're leaving around everywhere, right? I mean, it's turned into a very personal kind of decision. Even though what it is that we're talking about, right, are these large-scale global changes that reflect cycles happening over millions of years that in some sense what we do in some indirect way impacts on. Okay? But Rousseau is the one who really starts that line of thinking, because you might say, well, God, because, you know, one response to the global climate thing is to say, this stuff is just happening at such large-scale levels, the science of this is so uncertain, I'll just sit this out. I'll just, you know, let these scientists argue about stuff and see what happens, and I'll just do what I continue to do. But the fact that so many people feel that there's a moral obligation that they need to undertake with regard to this issue shows the extent to which this kind of Rousseau sensibility, right, has caught on, that people feel responsible to do do something, even about natural events, even when you cannot exactly establish the causal relation between anything you're doing and the consequences, right? Because these things are talked about in very general terms, right? There's no scientist who you can invite to your house to tell you exactly how it is what you're doing with your light bulbs is going to, you know, kill some polar bears somewhere, right? We don't have that kind of knowledge. Our knowledge is a much more general, abstract nature based on models, computer models. I'm not saying the knowledge is false, but the point is, the immediacy isn't there in the science itself. The immediacy is in somehow the way we interpret it, right, and put it in a certain kind of social context where we feel personally obliged to act on the basis of this rather abstract knowledge. Okay? And this sensibility goes back to Rousseau, and it's one of the things that then enables the public intellectual to actually have some purchase in public life. Right? So you get the scientist coming in with this global climate model telling you, my God, if you don't change your light bulbs and make them the right way so they're energy efficient, that in 25 years' time, half the species on the planet are going to become extinct. Now you might say, you know, this is completely stupid, right? Who could believe this? Well, actually, we do believe this. Right? We do believe this, and we do, and part of the reason we believe this is because we take personal responsibility for everything that's happening. Right? I mean, you may have read that this morning in the paper that there are these guys at York University who estimate now that half the species are going to become extinct if we just keep on going with our energy consumption. Okay? And the idea here is that we should be worried about this. This is always the assumption is we should worry about getting rid of all these species. Okay? That's interesting. So, but the thing is that, and so the spirit in which this kind of comment is made is for us to do something about it. This is not being reported just as a fact or an interesting conclusion that we've reached on the basis of our models, but rather this is something that ought to be put on the policy agenda and something people ought to be talking about. And see, Rousseau is the man who begins this kind of idea that in some sense human beings are responsible for acts of nature. That we have, you know, we can do something. That it is our fault when things go wrong. Okay, so what that does then is that it then makes it, it makes almost anything eligible for public intellectual discussion, doesn't it, right? I mean, if acts of nature become things that we can be held responsible for personally, right? I mean, it says global warming is the most extreme case. I suppose one could think of, you know, stars disintegrating hundreds of light years away from here, and then people kind of worry about that, say, we got to do something about that. I mean, I suppose that would be even more extreme. But the point is, the global warming thing is really a very extreme case of how we are being, how we think of ourselves as having personal responsibility for things that, on the surface, aren't really human. Okay, but public intellectual life depends very much on this. Now, the issue here about, I mentioned earlier about that if you do not take a stand, one, you know, if you don't take a stand opposing something, you're implicitly for it. Okay, this is very standard kind of public intellectual move, right? In a sense, there are no neutral people. There are no neutral people in public intellectual life. Okay, I don't know how you think about this. I mean, the argument that you may know Marxism. Here's an interesting question. Let me ask you a question about this. I know you all know about Marx and Marxism. I'm not going to ask you that question. But here's the word, ideology. Okay? How many of you would say, you're all sociology students, I suppose, how many of you would say that this word figures prominently in the courses you've taken as a concept, as a kind of concept for making sense of things? Put your hands up high if it's true.
Can you repeat the question?
Ideology. Okay, to what extent, I'm asking those of you who've taken sociology courses, to what extent does this concept figure prominently as a kind of analytic device in the courses that you're, you know, so in other words, things are explained in terms of ideology. To what extent do your lecturers, your course books say this? Put your hands up. Okay, those who don't really see much influence of the concept of ideology, put your hand up. Okay. Well, that's a little better than I thought. in the sense that I think this is a valuable concept still, but it is a concept in decline, okay? I mean, when I was a student, everything was explained in terms of ideology, just to give you a sense of of how the world used to work, okay? And the relevant point about ideology here is that ideology implies, at the very basic level, not only a sort of attitude toward the world, but an attitude toward the world that's sort of biased in a particular way. And it's biased in two respects. One respect is it's biased toward your interests, whatever your class interests or social interests happen to be. So you see the world in a way that's favorable to those. That's the one point. But the other side of ideology is that it's necessarily partial with regard to objective reality. That is to say, you only see part of what's actually out there, namely the part that actually suits you. Okay? Now, people have different theories about how self-conscious ideology is. You know. So, for example, you know, you might just go through school and you get, as it were, you get invested with an ideology. You don't even realize it, right? Because it's just the stuff you're learning. You have no alternative to compare it to. And so, you know, what you learn is just ideology in that sense. And your mind then gets narrowed and you only focus on certain things. Not because you chose to, but because that's just the learning process. But, of course, ideology can be something people deliberately adopt. When you join a political party, for example, or you join a special interest group and you start lobbying and so forth, then you deliberately do an ideology. Okay, public intellectual life takes this idea of ideology very seriously. Okay, and ideology is always something that in a sense has to be overcome. Right? And so, for example, when we get to this issue of those who do not support a position are against the position, then what do you say about the neutral people, the supposedly neutral people out there? Well, what public intellectuals often say, and this is where the Marxist tradition is very strong in influencing the way intellectuals think about themselves and society, is that people are basically prevented from getting an independent viewpoint. That there's some, that they have an ideology that, as it were, inhibits them from thinking that they actually need to take a decision on the matter. Okay, so for example, one ideology might be about how politics works, right? And there might be an ideology that says, well, you know, politicians just kind of run the show whatever way they want, and it just doesn't make any point to vote or to get involved in politics at all, because in the end, you know, it's all just going to come out the way the politicians want. Okay? Now that's a view that's ideological. It's based on a partial understanding of the reality of the situation, okay? But it's nevertheless in certain people's interest to believe that, okay? And so what a public intellectual is going to say is, look, people who think that they can be neutral about various kinds of matters are basically just contaminated or, you know, by a kind of ideology that makes them think that they can be neutral. But the public intellectual believes that, in fact, right, that all of us, in some way, whatever we do, are contributing to whatever happens in the world. Okay, and so for that reason, we actually have an active role to play. And people who say they don't make a difference are just fooling themselves. And that's where the ideology comes in. Okay, so neutrality, in a way, is a real big ideological target for public intellectuals. People who sit on the fence, they are kind of the scum of the earth for public intellectuals. And this is, you know, consequently, right, there's a sense in which public intellectual life only really exists in a state of conflict, right, where you got people pro and con, whatever the issue is. Mm-hmm. That people who are neutral are always seen as people who are potentially convertible to one or the other side. Okay, and anyone who thinks that they can just be neutral in general are just fooling themselves. Okay, so this is kind of very much the sort of public intellectual's way of thinking about the world. Now, if you're a politician, okay, this is a very tricky view, right? Because here's this public intellectual basically being a kind of an apostle of conflict. And if you're a politician, you typically want to be smoothing over the ruffled feathers so you can enable legislation and policy to sort of pass parliament or whatever. So in this respect, public intellectuals are very annoying figures, irritating figures. And so not surprisingly, they often end up getting censored or put in jail or sent out of the country or something like that. Okay? So that part of it is understood. Now, but one of the things that I talk about in the book is that it is possible sometimes to buy intellectuals. You can buy them. You know, if you're a politician, you know, as a policymaker, there are ways of buying them. And the history's full of this, too. One way of buying them is, of course, by making them your advisor. Right? Remember, public intellectuals are public figures, and so one of the things that they are very susceptible to, I think, is flattery. The whole idea of receiving public recognition. Right? Because here's this public intellectual, like Rousseau, and Rousseau is a great example of this, who in his entire life is completely paranoid, thinks that everybody's out to get him, feels he's always got to be on the attack. Every picture you see of Rousseau, Rousseau lived for many years in Geneva as a kind of exile, you go to there's a little museum in Geneva of Rousseau, and you see all these pictures and busts of him and things made in the late 18th, early 19th century, because he became a very famous figure relatively quickly. And they're all pictures of Rousseau looking straight at you. It's a very striking kind of thing. It's a very Enlightenment thing, right? I mean, if you compare paintings and through the ages, I mean, one of the things about the late 18th century when you get these Enlightenment guys like Rousseau is they're looking right at you. They're not like looking to the side or, you know, kind of reflective, looking at the ceiling the way a lot of 19th century kind of romantic types do. No, they're looking right at you. Right at you. Okay. And so there's this kind of inherent well, how do you deal with that, right? How do you deal with that? Well, one way is that you treat this not merely as a confrontational sign that the intellectual looks right at you, but that they're looking for recognition, right? So they want some acknowledgement from you. And so this is where the whole business of flattery can potentially work its way and kind of corrupt public intellectual sensibility, okay? So the intellectual then becomes a kind of courtier, a kind of advisor, right? A person who says things that the leader of the country then starts to mouth himself in speeches and stuff like this. I mean, you know, here's an example. Anthony Giddens. You've heard of Anthony Giddens, have you? All right. He's the best-selling textbook writer of sociology in this country, and actually in the English-speaking world, which is quite interesting. And this is the man who is typically given credit for the idea of the third way. This thing Blair was all about, right? This kind of thing between socialism and capitalism, but not quite the welfare state anymore, which was the original third way, but a kind of watered-down version of it, neoliberalized welfare state. And that's what Blair stood for. And the man who actually put those words on the table and Blair started mouthing them everywhere was Anthony Giddens. Okay, Anthony Giddens started writing a lot of books of that sort in the 1990s, early 1990s, and Blair, when he got into office, really made a big deal about all this, and Giddens has recently been knighted. Okay, now the interesting thing about this, of course, now people in this field in sociology have very mixed views about Giddens and about his career trajectory, you might say, because he went from being the leading social theorist in this country to being kind of the most influential policy person in this country, but supporting the status quo, essentially. I mean, you rarely see Giddens writing against the government. Right? Giddens will say some things that are tweaking at the margins, but he won't say anything directly against the government. Right? So there's no return to socialism with him or anything like that, for example. One reason why people hold Giddens, you know, kind of a diminished view of Giddens as a result of this participation in the third way is because they feel that in a sense he's kind of adapted his views over the years to make them more palatable to the politicians, so the politicians recognize him and then he gets closer to the seats of power. Now I'm not saying this is a correct interpretation of what Giddens has in fact been doing, but it seems to me that this is very much a very standard kind of reading of what this man's career has been like. Okay? And there are histories of these things. I mean, you may know, for example, the man who's often considered the most influential philosopher of the 20th century, Martin Heidegger. People familiar with him? Does that name ring any bells? How many people have heard of him? Put your hands up. Okay. This is a guy who, in your university career, you should run across at some point, I think. Heidegger was, well, he's been known as different things. He wrote a very famous book in 1927 called Being and Time. And he's what's known in the trade in philosophy as a phenomenologist of a certain kind. That is to say, he's very much concerned about the nature. He wants to understand reality through the human, through our experience. Okay? But, in fact, when I was a student, he was known primarily as an existentialist, actually. But that not so much anymore. But the thing that was really quite radical about Heidegger was that he wanted to understand, you might say, pure experience. That is to say, even without the identifying human characteristics, what is it like just to be in the world as anything? Fundamental question of being. Okay. Now you might say, wow, very abstract, difficult stuff, blah, blah, blah. The book's impenetrable, needless to say. You know, all that's true. Well, this guy was really keen on Hitler. Okay? Because Hitler was going to return us to fundamental nature of our being. We were going to, you know, we were going to get back down to brass tacks, what really matters in terms of the nature of life and reality and things of that kind. Okay? And see, Heidegger also had this kind of view, which Hitler capitalized on, which was the idea that, in a sense, for us to be in closest contact to our being, we have to sort of shed all these layers of civilization and urban culture and history that in a way kind of operate as a kind of filter, right? And we should go back to nature. So Heidegger was one of these guys who, you know, he would retreat to the Black Forest of Germany and, you know, and sort of commune with nature and get very spiritual about these kinds of things. And this was very, I don't know how much you know about Nazi philosophy, but Nazi philosophy was very eco-friendly, generally speaking. Okay, very eco-friendly, very nature-oriented philosophy, very suspicious of urban life, and very kind of wanting to, and actually then made all kinds of associations with Jews and smoking and all these bad things about life and alcoholism. So Hitler's like this teetotally vegetarian. I don't know if you know this, but Hitler was like this really prissy kind of teetotally vegetarian, nature-loving character. Now Heidegger becomes this kind of the house philosopher for Hitler for a couple of years in the early period of the Reich. And to the extent that Heidegger's own writings start to echo phrases from Hitler's speeches, and Hitler picks up some of Heidegger's jargon and puts them in his speeches. Okay? Heidegger eventually pulls out of the whole Nazi thing. He joins the Nazi party, but he pulls out and doesn't become part of the apparatus after about 2 years, once Hitler's in power, mainly because he doesn't feel Hitler's listening to him enough. And so, again, his ego is affronted, right? The issue of the intellectual demanding recognition. He didn't feel Hitler was giving him enough recognition. So he pulls out. And then, of course, you know, he sits out the war and all the rest of it. And then the Nuremberg trials, which is when all the Nazis get examined by the Allies to see to what extent they were involved in the Holocaust, right, in implementing it. Heidegger gets brought in, okay, as a witness. And Heidegger, of course, you know, had nothing to do with the Holocaust and all this. But one of the things that was happening in the Nuremberg trials was people were given the opportunity to renounce Nazism. And as you know, some did, some didn't. He never did. He never renounced Nazism. For him, he went to his grave thinking, the problem with the Third Reich was Hitler didn't pay enough attention to him. Okay? Now this is very much an intellectual's view of the world, I'm afraid to say. And this is where the issue of the need for recognition, right, to be taken seriously, right, that this can lead to all kinds of perversions, right, with regard to public life. Now, one guy who, I don't want to just single out Heidegger, on the left, we've got people, all right? And the person I mentioned in the book is be interesting to see if you know who he is. How many, Georgi Lukács, how many people have heard of him? Does that mean anything? You've heard of him, okay. Any of you who've done some Marxism would know about him, I think, okay? Lukács performed a similar role to Heidegger vis-a-vis Stalin. Okay, Lukács is Hungarian, trained in the German university system by training a kind of aesthetician, you might say. So very much concerned about the nature of art, beauty, and very much involved with theorizing the emerging realistic, naturalistic novel in the late 19th, early 20th century. That's kind of where he made his reputation initially. Okay? So you might say a very kind of high-minded philosopher, art, literary critic kind of person. Okay? But he also believed that, he believed that the Russian Revolution, he was really the first one to get on board in a very theoretically serious way, saying, look, the Russian Revolution told us something about how Marxism plays itself out in history. As you know, Marxists had lots of different attitudes about the Russian Revolution, whether it was a success or not, and all the rest of it. And so it was Lukács who's the person responsible for theorizing this idea of the proletariat. I mean, Marx talks about the proletariat, you know, the working class constituted as a class that operates in the world and causes the revolution. Well, Lukács is the real theorist of that. He's the one who really articulates what the proletarian science, because the proletarian worldview, proletarian science, all this kind of stuff. And this is the kind of ideology, right, that Stalin used to justify his regime. And there was this kind of, you know, for a good 20, 30 years, Lukács and Stalin were very much in each other's pockets. So Lukács never formally renounced Stalinism, and in fact was kind of there in the regime till the end. Sometimes he was in Moscow, sometimes he was in Budapest, and very often he was very careful about not upsetting Stalin by saying things, but still trying to be as critical as he thought he could be. And so, in a way, Lukács is a very interesting case, because it's quite clear this is a man who, by disposition, is a very critical person, right? Very kind of anti-authority, in a way. But at the same time, it's equally clear that he believed, genuinely, that Stalin was the vanguard of history. And that even though Stalin might be doing some horrible things, that nevertheless, you got to stay on board with the vanguard, because this is as good as we got at the moment. Things will get better in the future. And what you don't want to do is turn back the clock. So Lukács does this kind of double-think thing throughout his entire career. It's one of the reasons why he remains a very fascinating figure in the history of Marxism. Because he didn't just mouth party lines in some sort of mindless fashion. And he didn't just bail out of the whole Marxist program the way the Frankfurt School did, right? Because if you think about Adorno, Horkheimer, those guys pretty much just left. They kept the jargon, but left the politics, right, of Marxism. And that's most of academic Marxism today is of that kind, right? Most academic Marxists have nothing to do with politics, right? But they have a lot to do with jargon. But Lukács stayed in with the politics, okay? And so he's a very interesting figure. And depending on who you talk to, some people think this man was incredibly sophisticated and kind of did the right thing at the time and all that kind of stuff. And other people think this guy was a complete charlatan. You know, he just basically said different things at different times and covered up his tracks. Okay? But this is an example, another way in which a public intellectual, right, obviously seeking recognition from power and wanting to be responsive to power, because at the end, believing that ideas have power, right? Because, you've got to put yourself in the man's position. Suppose you were to see a politician who you believed was the future, right? Who believed was the person who's going to move history forward. And the reason why you believe this is because this guy already, knowingly or not, it already has some of your ideas. And of course, you think you're the most progressive thing in the earth, all right? Now, what do you do? Wouldn't you help him out? You see, this is the thing. Wouldn't you help him out? If you really believe in the power of ideas and you believe that what you believe is correct, wouldn't you help the guy out? And this is how all this begins, you see. Right? The public intellectual, in that respect, takes himself seriously. It's not just about talking about bright ideas for 45 minutes on a radio program and then going to the pub, right? I mean, this is serious stuff. But it has all of these, adverse political consequences. Because one of the things that people say against somebody like Lukács was that he actually, whatever role he may have had, with the Soviet Union, he had an enormous role with a lot of the Western Marxists, keeping their hopes alive. Right? Because he was able to address those audiences in his writings. so you get all these, you know, and Jean-Paul Sartre is a good example of this. A man who was like, you know, who basically supported every every Marxist-inspired atrocity, you know, in the second half of the 20th century. Nothing was ever too bad for him as long as it was on the vanguard of history. Okay? And people like Lukács justified that. All right? So there's a real serious issue here about the public intellectual's need for public recognition and where that might lead you. But the point is, if you're a public, you know, intellectual, you're something more than just an entertainer. Right? Because I do think there is a tendency, especially in our media age, right, you know, for the talking heads phenomenon, right, where people are just there, you know, like, you know, Newsnight Review, if you ever watch that on Friday, right, with Jermaine Greer and, you know, all, Tom Paulin and all these characters talking about the latest movies and books and things like this, right, and where these guys are just spouting off and saying kind of quasi-profound things for about 20 minutes and then it's over. Right, and then they go to the green room, have a few drinks, and they get taken off in their respective taxis or something, right? And I think to a lot of people that's kind of how they experience public intellectual life, very much in this kind of ephemeral manner, right? It just sort of is there as a kind of a little ritual you go through, kind of form of entertainment, and then it goes away and has really no substantive impact on you, except maybe it might you know, cause you to decide to go to see the film or buy a book, okay? But see, these guys are playing a much bigger game, right? They're talking about public intellectual life as influencing the public in a serious way, influencing society and changing the political order, that kind of thing. And that's supposed to be what this is about. Okay? So I think, you know, when you engage with this whole issue, you have to think about, well, how serious are you about it? Because if you are very serious about it, you're going to be led down the route of people like Rousseau and Heidegger and Lukács, who met with respectively different fates, but who, in a way, took very seriously the idea that the intellectual addresses you, puts you in a position to do something in the world to change society, that it's not just light entertainment. Okay? All right. I will be sending some additional readings relating to this for the seminar next week. And next lecture will be given by Elizabeth, and will be on public sociology. So the way in which this whole business applies to our particular field. Look forward to, students, you should look forward to hearing her next week.